Okay, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
If it's your first time to this session, we are in the book of Daniel, and today we're going to look at chapter 3. My name is Chuck Roper, and I'm leading this time for the 7 weeks that we're in this book, and this is our third time. And this chapter is a familiar chapter to many, especially if you've been raised in a church background and you know, you came up through Sunday school. You know, Daniel and his three friends in the fiery furnace is a very, very common or familiar children's story for Sunday school. And we need to look at it with fresh eyes because for them, it wasn't a children's story. They were facing a life and death situation with unknown consequences all the way through it. And so we want to make sure we take a look at it from their perspective. This chapter, I think, illustrates a lot as far as what our overall theme for this study is developing character in a compromising world. And they definitely provide an exemplary model for character building. In a situation that was oftentimes life-threatening, they faced jealousy and resentment and anger and rage and some immediate frightening consequences. And so we want to take a look at this passage today and see how did they face these circumstances. But let me open in prayer. Father, I do pray that we would have fresh eyes with this passage, that it wouldn't be something that we would easily read through or skip through, saying, oh, yeah, I'm familiar with this since, you know, fifth grade Sunday school class. But, Lord, that we would see what you want us to see from this passage about how you work in the lives of people who follow and honor you. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. All right. These men, we're going to see, we don't see Daniel at this point in time. We know he's in service to the king, which that may mean he's out on official government business. We don't know, it's not really said, but we're seeing here his three companions, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they are wrongly criticized and unjustly accused and manipulated to this horrible situation. And sometimes we're feeling the same thing of wrongly accused, unjustly, and we face some consequences that don't look very promising. And what should we do in those circumstances? And we see from these three men example that they certainly found favor with God. Last Sunday, we read in chapter 2, verse 47, let me read it for you again, where King Nebuchadnezzar says to Daniel, after the circumstances of this chapter, he says that truly your God is God of gods and Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you have been able to reveal this mystery. And we see here that Daniel is having the first encounter that we see recorded of where he's being able to give testimony of his faith, testimony of the true God over the Babylonian gods, that he is the one that is in control. And we see that Nebuchadnezzar's first encounter here with with the message of God, the gospel message. And we're going to see that he needs additional encounters. And we're going to see that in chapter 3 here. And so it's exciting, I think, to see as we look ahead and at the end of this chapter here to see what more does Nebuchadnezzar learn about the God of the Scriptures, the God of Jehovah. And we saw in chapter 1 that the chapter described them as being youths, probably about 15 to 18 years of age, that range. And then in chapter 2, at the end of chapter 1, they went into the king's service, and that took 3 years for them to get through that. So they were probably around 20 at this time, when at the end of chapter 1. Chapter 2, we saw that they moved. We moved ahead a few years. They were now working in the king's court. But here in chapter 3, we've moved on about 16 years from chapter 2. And how do we know that? It doesn't really say here. But in 300 years, 350 or so years before the time of Christ, King Ptolemy II, who was presiding over Egypt, commissioned that the Hebrew Old Testament be translated from Hebrew into Greek. And this exists today. It's one of the most wonderful manuscripts that we have. It's called the Septuagint. It's commonly referred to in the literature as LXX, 50, 60, 70. It's because he commissioned 70 scholars to translate the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek, which was the common language of the day. And so it's referred to, and in the margin, there's a note when they translated this, and it says that King Nebuchadnezzar had a large statue built in the 18th year of his reign, which would be 16 years after Daniel's interpretation of the king's dream in chapter 2. But there's this note, 300 years before Christ, in this translation, that somehow they knew that at this point in time that Nebuchadnezzar had built this large statue, which we're going to read about. And so if this notation is accurate, that puts Daniel and his three buddies probably in their mid to late 30s at this point in time. And as I said the first week, this is one of the reasons why I really like this book of Daniel's. We get to see the Lord working in their lives as teenagers, and then in their 20s, and now into their mid to late 30s. And as we work our way through more chapters, we're going to see later on, we get to see how these little windows, these little snippets into their lives about how God is working. And so here in chapter 3. So let's start out reading the first 18 verses. All right, I'll be reading from the ESV again. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. It's about 90 feet tall. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps and prefects and the governors and the counselors and the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the province to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps and the prefects and the governors and the counselors and the treasurers and the justices and the magistrates and all the officials of the provinces gathered for a dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O people, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning, fiery furnace." Therefore, as soon as all the people heard the sound of the horn, the pipe, the lyre, the trigon, the harp, the bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Therefore, at this time certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, the pipe, the lyre, the trigon, the harp, the bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning, fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, the pipe, the lyre, the trigon, the harp, the bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God, whom we serve, will be able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." All right. In chapter 1, we saw that they were supposed to follow the king's command that they eat from the king's table, and they proposed a test. And at the end of 2 weeks, if they passed the test, then they'd have no problem, and which they did. And so they never came under the king's attention or got under the king's anger over them because they passed the test. In the second chapter, we saw that the guard was at the door ready to put them to death. But they asked for time, and they were granted time. And they went and had a night of prayer. And they were able to, figure out, how they should respond to the king, as well as the Lord answered that prayer and gave them knowledge of how to respond to the king. But here in this chapter, it's immediate. There's no way to talk, 2 weeks. There's no time to prayer. It's like, decide now or off with your head. But we see these three guys here is they know immediately what they're supposed to do. They know, as God-fearing Jews, that they're not to bow down and worship any false idol. And so they're clear about that. And we see at the end here, they even tell the king that, so he's getting more of a sense of their devotion and their commitment to the Lord. And they say, the Lord may choose to rescue us, or he may not, but we aren't going to bow down. And so the situation is set up here. Over these 16 years, we saw at the end of chapter 2 that these three men, along with Daniel, had been set up as kind of overseers in Babylon and over the wise men, which the Chaldeans and the magicians and the advisors to King Nebuchadnezzar, they would have been over them. And they were heavily into the occult. And they surely wouldn't have been very pleased to have these three God followers, above them in the authority chain. And over those years, I have no doubt that they came to understand who Nebuchadnezzar was as a king, that he was noted for the drama. He was noted for being furious and getting his way. And they knew what his hot buttons were. And so they figure out a way that they can push those hot buttons of King Nebuchadnezzar and get rid of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and probably Daniel if he was around, all in one big fell swoop. And they'd be able to probably move into those positions of authority, and they'd be unrestrained by these God-fearing men over them. And so they come up with a scheme. They know how to manipulate the king and get rid of these three guys together. And so what they do is they go to the king and they tell him that these three men here are not going to bow down. And I love how they phrase it. Let me see here if I can pick that up again. Let's start at verse 8. "At this certain time, Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared, 'O King Nebuchadnezzar, O King, live forever. You, O King, have made a decree that every man who hears the sounds and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image, and whoever does not fall down and worship them shall be cast into the burning fiery furnace.'" And here's the plot. "There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province. These three guys. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Notice the word "you" is repeatedly said here. It's like, okay, you know, we just want to point out to you, king, that, you know, these three men who you appointed and you said should do this and you said everybody should do this, they're the ones that are disagreeing and disobeying you. Well, push the hot button, push the hot button. The king goes ballistic. You know, drama all the way. He loves a big show. He's got all the important people gathered together to see this statue. This statue is about 90 feet tall. It's not the whole statue being 90 feet tall, but it's this golden statue, and it's sitting on a pedestal. And the overall height of the whole thing is about 90 feet. So I get this. Maybe you've seen some of these images like from Egypt of this time where they have these obelisks that are really narrow and really tall. It's that kind of thing happening here where there's this, you know, there's this pedestal, and on the top of it is this guy up here. And that's a guy. And so there, it can be seen from all over. And so when they hear the music, they're supposed to fall down and worship it. But these Chaldeans and the other advisors to the king, they're going to say, hey, look at Neb. These guys who you appointed, they're not doing what you commanded. Are you going to let them get away with that? How does that look to everybody else? All the important people are here. And your top guys over the city of Babylon aren't doing what you commanded. That doesn't look too good to everybody around you. You know, that you may not be this king that you really think you are. And it, well, the king goes ballistic. He uses the word what? Furious rage? And he says to them, all right, let's talk to these guys. So he brings them in. And he goes through the command again, gives them another opportunity, wants to see for himself. And maybe when they're in his presence, they'll acquiesce and give in and do this. And, you know, he'll be vindicated with his control and his authority. And they come in and he gives them the same command and everything. And they refuse to do that. And they tell him why. We're not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up, and it doesn't matter whether you throw us in a fiery furnace or not. And in verse 19, Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and an expression of his face was changed against these three men. Ooh, can you just feel the drama at this point? Feel the tension. Everyone around them is kind of like stepping back a little bit, thinking, I don't want to be associated with these three guys. And you can just feel, you know, the Chaldeans and his other advisors there on the side, you know, kind of like, oh, we've got these guys now. They're caught. There's no escape out of this thing. Well, the thing I find interesting is Nebuchadnezzar's decree. Where he says that there is no God that will be able to deliver you out of my hand. In verse 15, who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? To me, that's like putting a target on your chest, saying, God, you know, here's the number one and most important person in the universe at this point in time, the king of all the known world at this point, saying he's challenging God, and God is going to take this challenge up. And so, I'll talk louder. We're going to read now in verses 19 through 30. Let me pick up the story. Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace heated seven times more than it was usually heated, And he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and other garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who stood up, who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, the Chaldeans and the magicians and others, "Did we not cast three men bound into the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." He answered and said, "But I see four men unbound, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt, and the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods." Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the firing furnace. He declared, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." Then they came out from the fire, and the satraps and the prefects and the governors and the king's counselor gathered together and saw that the fire had not any power over their bodies of those men. The hair on their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, "Blessed be the God of these three men who have sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree. Any people, nation, or language that speaks against the God of these three men shall be torn limb from limb, and their houses laid in ruins, for there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. This is a pretty exciting chapter in many ways. You know, these three men were faithful to God in the face of Nebuchadnezzar being furious before God. These three men defied an earthly sovereign king, but not a heavenly sovereign king. They knew it was, they were not to worship any false god or any graven image. And there was no room for compromise because they knew it clearly violated biblical mandates for them. And they said before the king, "We don't need to defend ourselves in this matter. It's clear. We're not going to compromise, even if you throw us in the fiery furnace." And we see here that they trusted God, even if God might not save them. You know, he had saved them the two prior times and probably a lot of other times that we don't see even recorded here. We saw him save them in for the 2 weeks of eating vegetables. We saw them being saved from being, you know, killed with the sword when the guard was at the door because they, you know, they needed to interpret a dream that the king kept having. And now they said, you know, God is able to save us from this fiery furnace, even one that's heated up like this one. And we know that he is able to, but he may choose not to for whatever reason. It's up to him. So the choice, and probably the temptation that was before these three men, it was a huge test of their faith. You know, they could have, I'm sure it went through their minds, they could have said, "Why not bow externally, but not worship internally?" Who would know? Just go through the motions. You know, they could be bowing before this idol and praying to the true God. Or they might have thought, if we get put to death, who's going to do all the good that we're able to do? We're in positions of power and authority. We restrain the king's advisors, who we know just from this that they're pretty malicious people. They're willing to manipulate the king to try to get their own way. Even the king was afraid of them in chapter 2 when he wanted them to tell him his dream because he was afraid that they would just make up a story to deal with the king's anger or wrath in that and make it sound good to them. And so they might have thought, you know, if we get put to death, who's going to stand up against these guys? And who's going to do the good in the kingdom? Or they may have looked at that fiery furnace. It was right at hand. And they may have thought, boy, that looks pretty fiery and hot. And the king looks even hotter, hot-headed to the max. And he's got a penchant for drama. We see that here. But they're very clear about it. They respond with wisdom and tact, and they take up Nebuchadnezzar's challenge, relying upon God. And so they get thrown in the fiery furnace. It's interesting to me that they make the fiery furnace even hotter, so there's no doubt. And the two or three guards that take them to be thrown in the fiery furnace, they suffer, sadly, the consequences of the king's rage, and they die immediately. It's that hot. It's coming out. But with Nebuchadnezzar, he notes that there's nothing happened to these guys. In fact, they're walking around. They were bound when they were thrown in. Now they're unbound. And not only are there three, but there's four men that he sees in here. They're unharmed by the fire. They come out, and not even the hair on their head is singed. Their clothes are unharmed by the fire. There was not even the smell of the fire on them. A few years back, the house across the street from us in our subdivision caught on fire. They had run their fireplace. It was in February time of the year, and they had run their fireplace, their wood fireplace, quite a while, and it heated up the flue above, and it caught the roof on fire, the attic. I don't know if there was insulation against the flue or whatever, but it caught the house on fire. It was pretty dramatic. It wasn't just a little fire. The upper floor of their two-story house was burning. And the trucks came, and all the neighbors came out, and it was a pretty big deal. And they were able to put that fire out pretty quickly. And over the course of about 6 weeks or 8 weeks, you know, they took down the top half of the house, and the construction guys came back, and they rebuilt the top of the house, and even nicer than it was before. But in addition, they had a lot of these companies come that dealt with the unburnt part of the house because of the smoke. It was in the carpets. It was in the furniture. It was in the curtains. You just couldn't get rid of the smoke. Where we live now, we live in a duplex condo, and the other half of our condo is up for sale, and they just had an open house last Sunday, and so Diane and I walked through it, being good snoopy neighbors. We wanted to see what they were doing, and as soon as we walked in, they had done a lot. They had painted, they had replaced fixtures, they had done all kinds of things. Immediately it hit you that the prior tenant owner here had smoked, and smoked a lot, and they just couldn't get rid of that smell, and they need to come back and clean those carpets more and do more. But it was like, whoa, you know, the smell was really strong. So here are these three guys standing in this fiery furnace, and their hair isn't even singed. There's not even the smell of smoke on them. I'm sure if the guards had lived, just throwing them in would have come away with the smell of smoke on them. And here the king notices that there's not even the smell of smoke on them at all. And they see that they're joined by a fourth. And Nebuchadnezzar makes the comment that he looks like the son of gods. What are some of the lessons that are illustrated for us in this chapter? Are there any that come to mind even to you at this point? I have some thoughts, but I'd be curious to hear your thoughts. What are some of the lessons that we are already seeing out of this chapter?
Well, remember the Iranian pastor who was released and persecuted in Iran, I think. He suffered. He said the one time he was going to deny the Lord, but then he did not. And he heard the voice of God telling him that that he'll be rescued. The thought that came to my mind is that we live in America. We didn't seem to think that this kind of thing would be possible. But I think it's coming on us. The religious liberty taken away from us, just as Daniel and the friends, the religious liberty was forcefully trying to be taken away. So what should we do now, or what should we prepare for ourselves for that time when it comes? I think we need to prepare ourselves daily to build a strong faith in our heart, to experience God very real in our life, even today, every day. Because Daniel did not, and his friends, they were forcefully taken from Israel to captivity in Babylon. That must be agonizing, just think of us. But their faith was so strong. Look at the prayers of Daniel on chapter 2. I mean, you know, that prayer that he knows who is the God of the universe. He knows his Savior. So I was just thinking when you were just reading chapter 3 and talking about all these, we need to have a very close relationship with God and pursuing Him, so that preparing ourselves like Daniel was so strong.
That's one of the reasons why I like Daniel, this whole book, is because it's far beyond just an historical account of the nation of Israel. It provides such a clear example and model for us. And yeah, maybe we're not standing before a king and throwing, you know, with danger of being thrown into a fiery furnace. In parts of our world today, yes, that is true, and I wouldn't be surprised if it ends up here at some point in time as well. But I love this book and the example that Daniel models for us. And that is through all the different seasons of his life. It's not just what happened to a young boy or a middle-aged man or a very old person. It happens all the way through his life. So there's times in their lives that are matching each of our lives in different times and seasons. Other lessons that you see already.
I like this chapter too. Daniel chose to be set apart. He didn't blend in. He wasn't affected by those around. And as a result, in verse 28, the situation that he's placed in causes Nebuchadnezzar. And so the lesson for me is, does my life point others to Christ? I mean, if I'm so blended in and they can't tell me apart from one another, that's a problem.
In verses 17, 18, I think there's something there. But these guys are not saying, we'll meet you at your level, we will make your fire ineffective, and all these things we'll do to you. They're saying, my God is capable of saving us, but I'll leave it to Him.
They don't presume.
Right, we leave it to you. So that's very, very telling as an example for us.
Thank you. Yeah. Shelley?
I also wonder what's happened in the in-between times with these guys, because there's no way they could stand up like this if they hadn't continued to follow God all these other years when they were just the ho-hum days of being in captivity and serving. So, I mean, I would just assume that they continue to walk with God all those years, and that's what made them strong and made them unwavering in the situation.
Definitely.
A few simple practical things as Christians in Ann Arbor. We love Ann Arbor. We enjoy the nice university, very good university, and so much blessings on many students who are very good students coming here to study, and so many capable faculty members who believe in the Lord, you know. But in many situations, we do not face up to our faith. Students do not let their friends and classmates and roommates know that they are following the Christ. Many faculty do not even know other Christians in the same department. Why? Because they do not let people know that they are Christians. 30 years ago, there was a young faculty. The way he introduced himself as a faculty was he went to the church first time. This is my first day. This is my name. And this is my office room and my telephone. If you have any problem, come and see me. And I just want to let you know, I follow Christ. I'm following Christ. Guess what? He lost his job. You know? And as believers too, or even faculty or members of the university hospital or faculty departments, you know, they shy away. Should I say some, not all, shy away from really proclaiming their belief. They don't have to impose on the other people around them. They don't have to impose, oh, come to church, I want you to believe in Christ. But they can really proclaim their belief. I'll tell you a story, really dramatic, is that we used this for medical students at DNA, what do you call it?
CMDS.
No, not CMDS, the one where we protect life. You know what is the oath that a medical student take?
Hippocratic
oath. So we organize Hippocratic oath.
Hippocratic oath dinner.
Hippocratic oath dinner, okay. I want to say something, but I'm not going to mention who. So I invited a friend who is in a very prominent position in the country, you know, and he accepted, you know. I did not really tell him, I did not keep any secret from him, but later on he found out that he called me. He said, Joaquin, I learned that this group is really very strong pro-life. Well, Hippocratic Oath Banquet, what else? So I asked him a question straight back. I said, by the way, I want to ask you a straight question. Are you really reluctant to come? You know, do you have any concern? Tell me, would you prefer that I look for another speaker? And his answer was very honest. He said, yes. So I changed the speaker. So sometimes we may be in very high position, but still we shy away. Yes, sir.
Thanks, Joaquin. You know, as I look at this passage, you know, I agree with the things that have been said here. The thing that sticks out to me is that Nebuchadnezzar had put out a challenge. He had said, what God will be able to rescue you from my hand? And there is one God that could do that. And he chose to do that. It's the true and living God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And so God is more sovereign than the most sovereign king of this known world at this point in time. Is that this is an example of God saying, okay, you're going to give me a challenge, I'm going to meet that challenge, and I'm going to rescue these guys. Another thing I see here is that suffering happens, whether it's fair or not. You know, here were these three men, and Daniel too, you know, that were wholeheartedly following the Lord, even in the midst of some pretty dramatic, trying situations. But yet suffering happens to them. You know, they were unjustly, maliciously, probably motivated, the Chaldeans motivated by jealousy and wanting to have control and power. And so they worked out the situation. They pushed the king's hot buttons. They made what they thought was an unbreakable way of getting rid of these three guys over them. And so sometimes suffering happens, even to people who are faithful. And these three guys knew it. And they said, God is capable, but we're not going to presume that he is going to rescue us from this. And so he may, in a different situation, chose not to. And they said, even if that's the case, we're still going to follow after him. Boy, that's a big one there. It'd be a whole lot easier if you knew 100% assurance that God was going to do that. But here they didn't know, and I would assume probably thought, well, this is it. Because that doesn't happen every day of the week type thing. So suffering does happen. I believe, too, like it says in verse 24 here, that King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and he rose up in haste. That when God works, it astonishes, it amazes non-Christians. When they see this, here he leaped to his feet. And when they came out of that fiery furnace, you know, the whole crowd gathered around them. Hey, I would too. You know, they wanted to see, you know, had anything happened to these guys. And they're amazed. They're astonished. When non-Christians see God at work, they're astonished. And I think it says here is that God's purposes were revealed. He showed all the important people of the Babylonian Empire at this point in time that big statue, that 90-foot statue, is not worth the worship. And the king gives his very dramatic edict again that the God of, you know, these three men is the only true God, and no one should bow down to any other false god, and they should only, you know, that's just amazing. Think where we started out this chapter and where we at again. King Nebuchadnezzar is moving along in his understanding of who God is, and he still hasn't learned the lesson yet fully. He still hasn't come to faith yet fully, but he's on his way. And so, at the very end of the chapter, verse 30, the king promotes them again in the province of Babylon. Oh, can't you just feel the Chaldeans and the magicians and the enchanters and all that? Foiled our perfect way of getting rid of these three guys totally backfired. And now not only are they still over us, but they even got more position, more power, more favor with the king. What happened here? This was perfect. And go, God says, no way. You know, I'm going to deal with you guys, and look at what happens. You're not going to get away with all of this. God does amazing things. And they're foiled, and the king is astonished, and everyone else is directed to worship the true God. When Diane and I first moved to Ann Arbor, it's quite a few years ago, I was driving a Dodge Shadow. And if you know cars, the Dodge Shadow is like the bottom of the bottom cars. And this car was so bottom, it didn't even have carpet in it. It had a sheet of vinyl in the bottom of it. And that was, it came that way, new. And I drove that thing for 13, 14 years. It was like this horrible little car. It was great. One day, after about 13, 14 years into it, I was driving north on Huron Parkway and was coming up to the intersection of Geddes Fuller, right there by Huron High School. And I was going to make a left-hand turn to head towards North Campus, you know, the VA hospital and all that in there. And that intersection is three lanes wide on each side, and then two lanes or three lanes on the other side, and it's a big bottleneck for traffic. And I'm coming across that bridge on Heron Parkway with my 13-year-old Dodge Shadow, and I'm going to make this left-hand turn, and I'm usually running late, and that light takes forever because there's all kinds of cars backed up and everything. And I come down that over that bridge, and I get into the left lane, and there's cars in front of me and going through the intersection, and so I push in the brake, and it goes right to the floor. And at that time it didn't have a handbrake in it like the cars do nowadays. It has the little foot brake, you know, the parking brake is way up inside. I'm stomping around in that car trying to get that thing. And the lane opens up right in front of me, and the car's going crosswise this way. I shoot right through them and turn on to Fuller and pull off to the side. Not a hair on my head was hurt. There was no singed smell on me. And I just sat there totally amazed, saying, God, you have totally just protected me. And it was a clutch car, so if you're good at working a clutch, you can downshift for braking. And so I pulled out back into traffic and worked my way home and just downshifted when I needed to come to a traffic light and put it out in the street in front of my house. and got underneath the car a few days later and saw that the brake cable had snapped on it. And like I said, it was a Dodge Shadow, 13, 14 years old in that. But the car was soon to be doomed. It ran for a little while longer, but it basically quit one morning out in front of my house. And so it sat there for 3-4 weeks, and then the subdivision in the township says you can't leave cars on the street. You know, it was winter coming up soon, and you can't. So I push it into my driveway and just let it sit there. And this was just before Thanksgiving. And so it's sitting there, and Dinah and I are trying to go to campus, and we're juggling a car between the two of us, and we had three little kids at the time, and money was short, and so I'm thinking, okay, what do? I got to find a different car. And I said, well, I'll deal with it after Thanksgiving. And so the day after Thanksgiving, I get this phone call, and it's from a friend of ours that I haven't talked to in probably 10 or 15 years. I've known him probably at that time for about 20 years, back in the west side of the state of Michigan where I'm originally from. And he calls up, and there's no caller ID on phones at that point, but he calls me up, and he says, is this Chuck? And I go, yeah. And he says, well, I wasn't quite sure I had your number. I wanted to track you down. And I go, yeah, you got me. What's going on? I haven't talked to you in quite a while. And he says, okay, do you need a car? And I go, what? He said, do you need a car? And I go, yeah. And he says, well, I was at my brother-in-law's for Thanksgiving, and he runs this gas station over in Berrien Springs area, St. Joe, which is on the other side of the state. And he says, we were talking that he got this car, came in, and he has this car, and it's a really nice car, and I was looking at it, and he says, you know, I wonder if the Ropers need this car. So he calls me, and he calls the next day, and says, do you need a car? And I go, yeah. And he says, well, can I bring it over tomorrow? And I go, yeah. And so he shows up in my driveway the next day with this car. And his wife drives along with him, so he has a way of getting back to the west side. He hands me the title and signs it over to me and hands me the keys and says, here you go. Now, that hasn't happened to me only once in my life. But I've told this story a lot. And when non-Christians hear this story, it's like, what? Who does that? How does this happen? And I just kind of like smile at him and say, this is God at work. This is God, and you're amazed. And it's amazing to me. You know, I'm not facing a fiery furnace. I did face, some traffic and just nearly, getting smushed or smushing somebody else. But I think about that often, is that God has met the need. He reveals himself, and the non-Christians that hear this are totally amazed that here's a God that does this. He's real. He works in your life. And I don't have anybody that's, repented on the spot and given me, turned their life over to Christ or anything like that. But I find it is they wonder, God is real. Who does such things? And it's a way that I've been able to share about the Lord with many, many people in that. I want us to turn in the New Testament in our last couple of minutes here to 1 Peter. Chapter 2. First Peter chapter 2. I'm in 2 Peter, that's why it doesn't make sense to me. 19 and 20. For this is a gracious thing, when, mindful of God, one endures sorrows while suffering unjustly. For what credit is it if when you sin and you are beaten for it, you endure? But when you do good and suffer for it, you endure. This is a gracious thing in the sight of God. You know, here's what happened to these three guys. Is they suffered greatly. I have no doubt that they, when they were being bound and carried to be thrown in the fire, that they probably thought, this is it. We don't see God rescue every day of the week like this. He can, but chooses not to. But, you know, they suffered unjustly and suffered greatly. But it says here that they found favor when they bear up under sorrows, when suffering unjustly. And what it did is it revealed their trust in God. This test, this drama that the king set up, this unbreakable way of getting rid of these three guys by the Chaldeans, is that through the midst of all of this, this story reveals to us that their trust in God did not waver, even when they thought it was the end. And it also reveals the faithfulness of God. God revealed His faithfulness to them. They saw God work. Can you imagine their character, how it grew in leaps and bounds as a result of this circumstance? When they went home later that night and gathered together, at least the three of them, or maybe with friends or family or spouses, I don't know who all was there, but can you imagine the story and the sharing and the rejoicing and all that went on, and how the, you know, their faith just was to give glory to God? Look at the story of God and what He's done, His faithfulness to us. And I have to believe that by responding with endurance, it points to the reality of the righteousness, the omnipotence, and the sovereignty of the true God to them. That this story now, here in our Bible, points us to that fact alone, that God is a righteous God, that God is omnipotent, that God is sovereign. Their lives, because they chose to follow after Him, provides a model or an example for us. So I want to leave you to consider that question further. Why would patiently enduring harsh treatment for doing right find favor with God? It's worth really dwelling on and reflecting. You probably will never face a fiery furnace in your life, but there's probably going to be times when you are accused unjustly, or a co-worker does this or that, or someone, you know, is unhappy with you, and you face harsh situations. How do you respond in those ways, in those times? Like these three men, we're all challenged to say, God, He is faithful to me. I'm going to choose to follow Him, even if He doesn't rescue me from this hard situation, and see God work. Let me close in prayer. Father, I thank You for the example of these three men and Daniel. I thank You that we can follow their example. And we see You orchestrating and working through these circumstances. Even in the midst of this hardship, You're providing a witness of the reality of the God of this universe is alive and in control, far beyond any powerful king or person. Lord, I pray that You would use our lives as You use these three men to give witness of Your glory and of Your power and of Your sovereignty. Lord, when we're faced with these challenges, I pray that we'd be mindful of the story of Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, that we would come back to our minds and follow You wholeheartedly. In Christ's name I pray. Amen. Chapter 4 next week. More interesting from here on.